From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And have we got a show for you, because we have handpicked from OTM's overflowing archive only the plumpest, juiciest fruits of our last year's broadcasting harvest. And this was an eventful year, our first year in this revamped format of On the Media.
Of course, the event that dwarfs the rest is the one that shook the country, not to mention our own offices in Lower Manhattan, to the core. OTM's producer-at-large Mike Pesca assembled this look back at the first 2 days of coverage after the Twin Towers fell.
We didn't know it then, but early Tuesday morning, America was a normal place. The American media were operating as normal. The front page of the New York Times featured a primary that few New Yorkers had been paying attention to. Fergie was discussing weight loss on Good Morning America. Mr. Peanut had shown up on the set of the Today Show. And then the first plane hit.
We just got a report in that there's been some sort of explosion.
The terrorists had already succeeded on one count, gaining media attention. And with the cameras trained, the second hit.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center.
Within half an hour, a New York landmark was toppled.
The entire building has just collapsed.
The whole side has collapsed?
The whole building has collapsed.
The whole building has collapsed.
The nation's confidence was shattered.
Wait a second. Is this a live picture? This is a live picture. We are seeing the second World Trade Tower Center. World Trade Center Tower number one has just collapsed, ladies and gentlemen. You see it live in our picture.
2 hours prior, the biggest news story of the year was Chandra Levy. But here now was disaster layered on disaster multiplied by the prospect of war. A U.S. airliner has not been hijacked for over a decade. Four were hijacked on that day. Buildings were falling, the symbols of American power were burning, and the tape was rolling.
This is taped just a short time ago. This is the best look we've had at the damage at the Pentagon, where another plane apparently made a suicide plunge.
For the first few hours, the television infrastructure of 21st century America paid off. Having 30 cable channels was actually a good thing. Every channel offered a different news feed, while news consumers edited with their remotes. But with all those options, viewers had the responsibility for distinguishing fact from fiction.
Breaking news on WCBS 880, right here, right now.
We don't know if this is simply rumor, and the way people talk when something like this happens, it is certainly not fact at this point. Something has happened to the State Department. We don't know what yet. We hear that it might have been a plane. Stay with us for the very latest on that angle. There are fresh developments, moment by moment.
Confusion in the streets and in the newsrooms. That story wasn't true. These sources weren't reliable.
According to reports, and I want to stress this is coming from the affiliate there who got this from the scanner, so let's put this in perspective.
News outlets were putting it all out there, correcting things as they went along.
We've since disproved, by the way, with apologies to our viewers, that there was ever a car bomb at the State Department. We have knocked down that there was ever a plane crash at the presidential retreat in the Catoctin Mountains, Camp David. Those stories not true. Associated.
While Brian Williams on MSNBC and most of the other networks concentrated on the effects of the terrorism, CNN was the only one to take viewers to the home of suspected perpetrator Osama bin Laden.
This is a Taliban spokesman talking now. This is coming to us by video phone from Afghanistan.
The video phone didn't offer as clear a picture as a camera, but none of the other supposedly global news-gathering organizations had been willing to pay for a reporter and equipment in this remote region. By day's end, no network had gone away from the story or even aired a commercial. They even shared each other's tape and gave each other credit. The rules of broadcasting had begun to fade. On Wednesday, TV was still attempting to provide a public service. Websites and local news stations allowed people to air their grief and publicize pictures of the missing.
Well, if we get that picture from you on our list website, we will certainly put it up, and we will do everything here to do what we can.
Can I leave you my number?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
If anybody has any information Joseph was wearing a black pants and a black short sleeve shirt. My number is 718-227.
Still, things were beginning to revert to form. Theme music had been assigned. Individual networks were attempting to brand the events of the past day. When the story broke, the graphic on the Fox News channel read Day of Terror, with the word terror presented in a font that seemed to be dripping blood. Soon thereafter, the graphic changed to Terrorism Hits America, with terrorism in more restrained block letters. MTV was back to playing videos, interspersed with public service messages of special import to the MTV audience.
You must be 17 years old to donate blood. You must be 110 pounds. And you cannot have been tattooed or have had any ear or body piercings in the past 12 months.
The Gulf War was CNN's finest hour. Now the Fox News Channel was attempting to make this their loudest. A national crisis would not divert Fox from the formula of opinionated primetime hosts. Here, host John Gibson berates a terrorism expert for urging caution.
There's a good deal of anger right now, and the country is behind a response. Why wait while we have a bunch of Sherlock Holmes going around and nailing down exact connections everywhere when we know what happened? We know it's bin Laden.
By Thursday, things had calmed down a bit. America was busy, in the words of Dan Rather, redefining normal. For television, normal was sustained shots of a pile of rubble where the World Trade Center once stood. There were so many stories to tell, stories of the missing, the displaced, the suspected. Stories told in the familiar vernacular of the modern media.
Lying in that rubble, a simple rag doll, a sad reminder of all the lives that were forever changed.
Once again, television used theme music and bold-faced titles to package a tragedy. That durable device, the simple rag doll, is in fact mostly a reminder of the limitations of those who resort to drama because they can't convey the reality.
Six minutes before the first plane hit Tower Number 1, CNN was airing a segment called Huge Buzz Surrounds Designer Liz Lang's Maternity Wear. That's standard fare in what's been called more innocent times. On the other hand, ABC's Nightline was planning to air a multi-part documentary about the situation in the Eastern Congo. Nightline somehow manages to thrive on programming like that. But the widely held assumption in network news is that there is no mass audience for such a show, that Nightline is a niche program. Back in October, we asked Nightline host Ted Koppel what he thought.
I don't know. I mean, it clearly is a niche program. I think by and large, we do more serious programming than a lot of what gets on the magazine programs, for example. We would have been off the air a long time ago if we were in prime time because our ratings would not have been high enough. At 11:30 at night, they're just fine.
When we asked Don Hewitt about what should other news magazines do to achieve the stature of 60 Minutes, he said they can't because there's only one Mike Wallace, Ed Bradley, and so on. And he was happy that his show alone enjoyed that exalted status. Would you want a lot more shows that do essentially what your show does?
I'm not sure. On the one hand, I think it would be good if an audience would sit still for that kind of programming throughout other parts of the programming day. On the other hand, I'm a realist, and I know that if you had a program like Nightline and a series on the Eastern Congo, for example, up against West Wing or ER or whatever else is hot in programming right now, what's that CBS program, the really big one with the people out on the out in the brush trying to
Survivor?
Do each other in. Thank you, Survivor. I'm probably the only person in the Western world who has never watched it. But if we were up against that, we would do very poorly. They would kick our butts. I have no doubt of that.
You are the closest thing we have to a diplomat without portfolio, in that you talk to more leaders than anyone not employed by the State Department. If they give you an answer you don't like, you go after them. When interviewing a Taliban official, have you ever had the impulse to pull back simply because you are an American and castigating the Taliban might not be in our national interest? Would you, for instance, ask General Musharraf about India's charge that the government of Pakistan is itself a sponsor of terrorism.
Oh, sure. Why not? My function is not to go over there and either deliver a warning in behalf of my government or try to bring about some kind of a solution in behalf of my government. My function, and it, I think we're all well advised as journalists not to forget that. We don't operate as diplomats. I hate the term television diplomacy because it's an oxymoron. It doesn't exist. I mean, it sort of first came into popularity when Barbara Walters and Walter Cronkite interviewed Sadat and Begin, and there was sort of the world was left with the impression that they had arranged for these two men to meet together and that it never would have occurred to either one of those two guys that they could sit down and have a conversation if either Walter or Barbara hadn't mentioned it to them. That's nonsense. That's not our function. It's not what we do. We're out there to get information. We're out there to tell the story to the American public in as clean and direct a fashion as we can. If we don't do that, we deserve to be criticized. But we shouldn't be criticized for not being good diplomats. We're not supposed to be diplomats.
Now, David Halberstam, who's written a lot about the media, has said that whether the networks continue to cover foreign news the way it should be covered depends on the character of people like the head of your network, Michael Eisner. What do you think?
Well, let's put it this way. Over the past few weeks, and Michael Eisner and I have not spoken during that time, and I don't know this from anyone inside Disney, but I think I read it in either Time or Newsweek the other day, that all of the three commercial networks lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $400-500 million, each of them, not collectively. And probably before this thing is over, we'll have endured well over $1 billion worth of losses in the interest of serving the public, and therefore the notion that it can sustain losses of an additional few $100 million every couple of months, I just don't think is realistic. Are they continuing to say, by all means, go ahead and cover this story properly? Yes, they are. Is it costing them more money than it was costing them before? Yes, it is. Are they going to be able to do this indefinitely? No, they're not. But fortunately, I don't have to worry about that.
And why not?
Because I just keep coming into work every day and taking home sacks of money at the end of every week, which this generous corporation gives me for being here every day.
Ted Koppel, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Coming up, why leakers leak, some thoughts on cultural glue, and a time-delayed New Year's.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th's carnage, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld faced the press to deliver an important message, not to America, not to the international community, not to the media, but to his own Defense Department. It was a warning about leaking classified information because a leaker, Rumsfeld declared, is a threat.
It's a person who's willing to violate federal criminal statutes and willing to frustrate our efforts to track down and deal with terrorists and willing to reveal information that could cause the lives of men and women in uniform.
2 weeks later, USA Today ran a page one story detailing U.S. Special Forces operations already proceeding on the ground in Afghanistan. 2 weeks after that, President Bush was so infuriated at leaks from Capitol Hill that he tried to cut off classified briefings to all but a few members of Congress.
Some members did not accept that responsibility. Somebody didn't. So I took it upon myself to notify the leadership of the Congress that I intend to protect our troops.
In the end, the president had to back off because by law, the administration must keep Congress fully informed on intelligence matters. To many inside the Beltway, though, it was the president who seemed to be out of the loop. In Washington, leaking is not only business as usual, it's a way of life.
What the president was saying is, I can't believe that people are getting classified briefings and then leaking information. Come on, Mr. President. It's what happens every day.
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter, author, and founder of the National Security Archive, a repository of declassified information. He says leakers are not only ubiquitous, but necessary to journalism and democracy.
They're correcting things. Sometimes they're verifying things. This is how we get our information. It's an information economy.
And in the information economy, there is never a recession because there are too many journalists chasing too many bureaucrats and politicians with too many reasons to blab. One who reputedly did not blab was Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor in the Clinton administration, and someone known for being maddeningly leak-proof. Firth says that was a matter of integrity and discipline. Discipline, however, diminishes geometrically with each additional individual entrusted with a given piece of information.
You have a small meeting. Everybody in that meeting is extremely responsible, and nobody likes leaks of sensitive information. But they all go back from that meeting to their buildings, and they feel obliged to brief at least one or two other people who are very close to them and important to them operationally. And those people, in turn, brief one or two people who are important to them operationally, and pretty soon you have traversed 6 degrees of separation, and the information has crossed the barrier and is in the public domain.
Beyond carelessness, a main category of leaks comes from disaffected insiders, bureaucrats or political appointees wishing to influence debate or expose blunders within their own agencies. And then there's a third variety, the vanity leak.
And that is that somebody has this information and just can't keep quiet about it and wants to talk about it as a way of basically showing off.
Reporters need to understand those various motivations in order to evaluate the substance of a given leak. But mainly, they're concerned with the steady flow of reliable information. Bill Gertz is on the national security beat at the Washington Times. So successful has he been in reporting classified information that he is said to be the main target of so-called official secrets legislation now percolating in Congress.
You know, as we say in the news business, you're only as good as your sources. So we focus quite a bit on being able to circumvent the official public affairs bureaucracy.
If that sounds like a perverse game, that's because it's a perverse game whose perversity is rooted in the fact that official spokesmen mouth the carefully parsed pronouncements of politicians who are worried about political consequences and therefore cannot be relied upon on any subject, including the weather. Even Leon Firth, the Clinton White House's Mr. Tightlips, acknowledges the credibility gap.
Dating back to Vietnam and Watergate, the press has had its reasons to be cynical about the motivations of government in wanting to keep information secret.
Even now, in the enlightened and transparent 21st century, the executive branch tends toward willy-nilly classification of innocuous information that properly belongs in the public domain. And when confronted by media organizations with leaked information for confirmation or comment, official Washington often reacts with reflexive cries of national security. This often leaves media organizations with difficult choices. When asked to kill or alter a story, they have to decide, is it really a matter of protecting military or intelligence personnel in the field? Or is the government just trying to shield itself from embarrassment or political fallout? And if the story is held, will it show up the next day in the competition, maybe with a spin favorable to the government? The Washington Times' Bill Gertz.
I can remember in one case we had a story about a CIA officer who was having an affair with an Eastern European intelligence officer, and the CIA had asked that we not publish it, and we didn't. And within a week, the story came out in another news publication.
Some leaks, of course, are well tolerated by administrations because the administration itself, for political or diplomatic reasons, has engineered the leak. Journalist Scott Armstrong.
If you can control the information and you leak it out selectively, you can control the press and you can control the public debate. That's the idea.
Divining what is strategic and what is actually a breach is all part of the game. 2 weeks ago in the Washington Post, reporter Bob Woodward had an exquisitely detailed story about attempts during the Clinton administration to capture Osama bin Laden. Attempts, according to the Woodward account, that were squelched by Saudi Arabia's refusal to participate. For leakologists, this was an irresistible brain teaser. Was the source old Clintonites? Democrats on the Hill? The Bush White House? Who? Armstrong, who was the co-author with Woodward on the bestseller The Brethren, has his own suspicions. They begin with Saudi diplomat Prince Bandar.
Anyone who's read Woodward's books that deal with the Persian Gulf War would have noted that there are a lot of quote marks around things that Prince Bandar has said. And when somebody tells me that the U.S. wanted to do something with Saudi Arabia, and I know that the principal line of communication throughout the entire period was through Prince Bandar to the Saudi government and back through Prince Bandar to the United States government, I put those two things together and come up with the most likely source of this information is a Saudi.
Leon Firth, for his part, doesn't much care who the source was. Nowadays, he's a visiting professor of international relations at George Washington University, but when he read the piece, his instinct was still to fear for the flock.
Let's say that the information that he reported is correct for the sake of talk, for the sake of discussion. Let's just say that it's correct. Then that would be damaging, because it would talk about, by implication, networks that we used, relationships that we had developed, kinds of influence that we could exercise, and our mode of planning and attack. And I recognize the press has got a problem because there's an infinite requirement for information and for visual images, but the country has a need. Now, is it the government's problem to solve this, or is it the press's problem to figure out how to deal with it?
It's a conundrum, all right. But one answer might be to look elsewhere in the world, where nobody dare leak and nobody dare publish and nobody knows what obscenity the regime is up to next. The citizens' protection is the responsibility of any government. Protection from the national government by a vigilant press and its confederates is a unique blessing of democracy.
In a place as large and as diverse as America, there's no single program that can qualify as a universally shared cultural experience. Certainly not this one. So in times of crisis, the common threads that unite us are not all that easy to find. On the Media's Sarah Fischko looked back to an earlier era for inspiration with help from audio engineer Wayne Schulmeister.
Since September 11th, I've found myself thinking about Dame Myra Hess. Myra Hess was a British pianist who became world famous as the organizer and performer of lunchtime concerts in London during the Blitz in World War II.
It started by wondering what to do.
Myra Hess recorded in 1962.
All the public buildings were closed, you know, concerts had stopped. Nothing was going on, and the blackout, you know, made it so difficult for people to get home.
Hess was concerned about the effect of a cultural blackout on Londoners. Not only concerts, but live theater and even movies had been virtually suspended in the city. And so, as bombers flew overhead, as air raid sirens blared, Myra Hess and various colleagues played and kept on playing. Every day they played, in London's Trafalgar Square, in the National Gallery, which had been emptied of all its art treasures due to the bombing.
The National Gallery was always crammed.
Pianist Michael Hamburg played as a guest artist in many of the lunchtime concerts. She was 19 years old at the time.
All sorts of people, soldiers on leave with gas masks slung around them, office workers sitting totally quiet, a lot of them on the floor, just to hear peerless music.
The lunchtime concerts ran uninterruptedly, amazingly, from October 1939 until April 1946, 5 days a week. 1,698 concerts in all, heard by more than 800,000 people.
It was lovely because we were wanted and people felt we'd come to give them some kind of message which they might not know what it was, but which they felt was lacking in their daily lives. It was a part of London life during the war which was extremely significant.
In fact, many said at the time, and since, that Myra Hess and her daily concerts were part of the glue that held the British together in wartime. Cultural glue. We're learning about its importance here in America, and it's maybe a little harder for us to find, but where we seem to be looking for it is on television. Not that we haven't looked there before.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end...
We looked to one particular avuncular news anchor in times of crisis years ago.
And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North.
But it's different now.
The three network system is long gone. We're fragmented.
Terrence Moran is a professor of media and culture at New York University.
We can't have Kate Smith singing God Bless America and having most of the Americans tuned in for that on Saturday night. We used to say television was uniting the United States. Well, television is fragmented now. And the internet has further fragmented us. And cable and satellites have fragmented us even further. So there really is no sort of core.
Unless you count late-night TV. It feels almost as if late-night has become our lunchtime.
Welcome to the Late Show.
The cultural routine.
Show on the air since New York and Washington.
The everydayness that we long to be back to.
Good evening, and welcome to the Daily Show.
And we are back to it.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the Tonight Show. Nice to have you all here.
Trying to laugh at what we fear the most.
Well, did you see those three Taliban leaders on the news announcing they have Osama bin Laden under control? All three of these guys have beards.
They hate America.
Why?
Well,
they don't get cable. What's the problem?
Lately, we've seen roles reversed and reversed again.
Here is Dan Rather. Dan, come on up.
We've seen anchormen cry.
If they could go down to ground zero and see the following. See those firemen? Take a minute, will you?
And politicians tell jokes.
Do you know what Osama bin Laden is going to be for Halloween? Dead.
Oh, dead.
Dead.
And funny men get very serious.
You can feel it. You can feel it. You can see it. It's terribly sad. Terribly, terribly sad. And watching all of this, I wasn't sure that I should be doing a television show because
we've seen it all on late night TV in the past weeks after our long, anxious days. We'd already seen the power of late night start to grow last fall during the presidential election.
It was the first time I can remember that comics were accorded political power.
Cecilia Tichy is the author of Electronic Hearth, Creating an American Television Culture.
It wasn't only the pundits, the so-called chattering classes, but that these guys cracking jokes were having an influence on the polls, on voters' disposition. So I think that, in a way, set us up for this moment when, in crisis, these folks come on and take on a new role vis-a-vis themselves and the public, and that role is to help further public education and, yes, to provide assurance.
What seems odd is that it is the same box, that same screen, that provides us with the cause and the cure. It is TV, almost like a sixth sense. Terrence Moran.
Marshall McLuhan famously said that media are extensions of ourselves. They're extensions of our senses and extensions of our nervous system. They're the ways in which we take in the information we need to survive.
TV is giving us the messages that help us feel our national coherence in a way that no space in our country can really do at this time.
It is really tense. I've been backstage at a lot of rock concerts. I have never seen musicians run away from white powder. I'm telling you.
In our time, it seems to be a TV smirk, a curled lip in late night that tells us it's going to be okay. And that may be the closest thing we've got to the stiff upper lip of some inspirational Londoners who simply showed up at lunchtime a long time ago. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
There was a time when you existed in either Eastern Time or Pacific Time, with a vague nod toward the Central and Mountain time zones. But now the rhythm of life is dictated by the universal feed time, as in when the network feeds the programming in your area. All this occurred to writer Matt Selman just about 1 year ago.
December 31st, 2000, 11:55 p.m. My girlfriend and I are about to ring in the new year from the best night spot in Los Angeles, bed. On TV, we look for an official New Year's Eve countdown show. Channel 2, no countdown. Channel 4, no countdown. ABC has Dick Clark in Times Square, rocking in the new year. On a 3-hour time delay. That's not now. That's yesterday. Right now in New York, it's almost 3 a.m. Dick Clark could be dead. Keep clicking. Channel 5, nothing. Well, Fox has a countdown. Also in Times Square. Also in the past. Back to Dick Clark. Girlfriend says. Change it. He's gross. Back to Fox. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 2001. 3 hours ago, a giant ball slides down a giant pole. 3 hours ago, drunk New Yorkers cheer. How many of them are dead by now? Most of them, probably. Kiss girlfriend goodnight. Lights off. Think about stuff in head before sleep. Los Angeles TV has no live New Year's Eve countdown show. What does this mean? LA runs on hype, but it isn't hyping New Year's Eve 2001. Well, good for LA. New Year's should be ignored. After all, doesn't New Year's always fail to live up to its own hype? Don't most revelers end up depressed? Let down? Don't most end up dead? But not in LA. No way. For us, New Year's Eve is over 3 hours before it's even begun.
Matt Selman is a writer for The Simpsons on the Fox Network.
Coming up, why Madison Avenue prefers its celebrities seasoned and deceased, and everybody's favorite media gift.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Welcome back to the special holiday, the staff has long since fled New York edition of On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with the final act of this year's On the Media. On that note, when is death not the final act? Answer, when Madison Avenue runs the show. Bob, you explain it.
Okay. Lou Gehrig, baseball's great Iron Man, amassed more than 5,000 total bases over 17 years before succumbing to the disease that would bear his name. Fatal illness, however, did not end his career, for while dead men cannot hit, they can still pitch.
Before you can inspire...
Today I consider myself...
Before you can touch...
The luckiest man on the face of the earth.
You must first connect. And the company that connects more of the world is Alcatel.
This ad for a French telecommunications company is just the latest in a series of resurrections popularized by the confluence of advertising ambition, celebrity obsession, and digital technology. In the past few years, to name a couple of notable examples, we have seen Fred Astaire dancing posthumously with a Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner and John Wayne flogging Coors Light from beyond.
I want to know whose beer this is right now!
It's my beer, Sergeant.
Let's put aside for a moment the issue of what appeal John Wayne holds for a generation of beer drinkers who mostly hadn't been born by the time the Duke sauntered into eternity. The real question is, when, say, Gilbert Gottfried and Bruce Jenner are just a phone call away, why go grave robbing?
In most cases, these people have a larger-than-life persona that we have either grown up with or we've watched for many, many years. They are forever frozen in time.
Bill O'Neill is vice president for marketing and promotions for CMG, the talent agency specializing in the talented but unbreathing. It was CMG that Alcatel dealt with to license the image of Lou Gehrig, who is but one iconic figure on a client roster that reads like who's who in heaven.
Babe Ruth, Vince Lombardi, Jackie Robinson, Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, some music figures of Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, Frank Zappa. Chuck's still alive, of course.
As agents, CMG must walk the line between protecting the images of its late clientele and exploiting them.
Well, I'm not sure I would use the word exploit. Market is a term that I would use. You know, we're very respectful of our clients and their wishes. You know, there's a lot of deals that have come our way that we have not done. But ultimately, they are a client, and we have a responsibility to try and generate some business for them.
unless, as good citizens and guardians of their clients' dignity, they have a greater responsibility. Gary Ruskin, executive director of the public interest group Commercial Alert, believes the invocation of Lou Gehrig for Alcatel is a travesty.
It's one of the most touching moments in sports, and it's really a shame to see it used by commercial hucksters to sell tawdry trinkets.
To Ruskin, this is yet one more example of how we are all sullied by the commercial culture, where everything, every human value, and now every legend seemingly are for sale. For instance, while Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, and Satchmo might have liked the idea of screen immortality, being channeled into a Diet Coke commercial probably isn't what they had in mind.
Now we get warm. Diet Coke!
Jingle courtesy of Elton John, Righteous Indignation by Gary Ruskin.
Nothing is sacred to them. There's nothing that they won't tarnish or despoil just to make a buck. We've seen Apple computers use Albert Einstein in their ads. Apple also used Gandhi. When you take a true hero and you drag him through the commercial muck, it tarnishes the hero just a little bit, and that's not right either.
It's the same with, you know, cloning human beings and whatnot. You start to get into an area that people are just a little uncomfortable with.
Stuart Cooper Ryder is a senior vice president and creative director at the advertising agency Arnold Worldwide, creator of the Lou Gehrig spot and an earlier Alcatel commercial featuring the I Have a Dream speech of Dr. Martin Luther King. That ad ignited a firestorm.
You know, the intention of this thing really wasn't to cause any pain to anybody, certainly. In our own hearts and minds, we really felt that we weren't desecrating him at all, that this was, you know, we were really honoring it. But I believe it was really when Matt Lauer decided that he needed to have our client on national television sitting down with the head of the NAACP. That's kind of when we realized that this thing was fairly large.
Lesson learned. Some imagery is sacrosanct, although it's hard to predict levels of outrage. For what it's worth, there was more bad press over Fred Astaire's Dirt Devil Pas de Deux than from Alcatel's expropriation of the defining moment of America's civil rights movement. Nonetheless, the advertiser is certain to tread more lightly from here on in.
Religion probably would be an area that we'd want to stay away from. You know, I think the Mother Teresa's and certainly popes and that sort of thing, we would probably want to stay away from, just out of respect.
But you won't see any general slowdown in celebrity resurrections, because the likes of Lou Gehrig and Louis Armstrong bring with them more than their legends, more than their nostalgia value, more than their iconography. They also bring their lack of police records. Furthermore, Stuart Cooper Ryder points out, formerly living talent is a pleasure to deal with during production. There are many deceased prima donnas, but no deceased who are still prima donnas.
Somebody comes in and screams at you because the limo was the wrong color. That happens regularly. The hotel room wasn't what they thought of.
Anyone dead ever scream at you over the color of the limo?
No, fortunately.
So, if you happen to be an actor or a pro athlete frustrated by Madison Avenue's indifference to your endorsement potential, take heed of Alcatel's real message. Before you can inspire, before you can touch, first you must, like totally, disconnect. Here's a commercial you might have missed.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
Before you can inspire,
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Before you can touch,
Miss Lewinsky,
you must first connect. And the company that connects more of the world is Alcatel, a leader in communication networks.
I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Kidding. Just kidding.
Dead men tell no tales, but these days, living directors are boosting their profits by spilling their guts on DVD. For instance, did you know that in The Usual Suspects you can glimpse a California palm tree in a shot that's supposed to be New York? Or that in The Cell, Miss Universe's naked breasts were created digitally in post-production? The extra features on DVDs offer an endless array of juicy tidbits for the cinephile, which is why, according to film critic Roger Ebert, the DVD player is the fastest-selling electronic device in history.
The DVD provides twice as much picture detail. It provides true surround sound. It provides all of these bells and whistles, all of the deleted scenes, the little essays, the making-of documentaries, the advertising campaigns, the trailers. It's just like getting a whole package about the movie instead of just getting a fairly low-quality tape.
DVDs, being the same size as CDs, are simpler than VHS tapes to handle and store and far less vulnerable to wear and tear. Ebert is thrilled because the high-quality image and sound allow home viewers to enjoy an experience much closer to the filmmaker's original vision. But you don't just see that vision. You can hear from the director, editor, cinematographer, designers, and actors exactly how they crafted it. And that is rapidly changing a nation of moviegoers into cineasts, full of all the arcane knowledge the word implies.
If you got five or six of the best DVDs, it'd be like taking a college course in filmmaking.
Richard Roper co-hosts Ebert and Roper and the Movies.
The first time you see a DVD picture and a DVD player, I think it's the moment you say, I'm no longer attached to my VCR.
Peter Becker, one of the pioneers of classic home video, is the president of Criterion, a company that meticulously transfers classic and contemporary films to DVD. The Criterion catalog ranges from RoboCop to Rashomon, and nearly every film is enhanced with additional tracks of expert commentary or rare bits of footage. For example, Criterion's vivid transfer of Carol Reed's 1949 The Third Man.
Graham Greene originally wrote The Third Man as a novel. He never had any experience of writing in script form, really. And Carol Reed said, fine, write me the novel and I'll make you the movie.
The DVD provides a reading of Graham Greene's original text over the video.
He called sharply, do you want anything? And there was no reply. He called again with the irascibility of drink. Answer, can't you? And an answer came, for a window curtain was drawn petulantly back by some sleeper he had awakened, and the light fell straight across the narrow street and lit up the features of Harry Lime.
Harry!
In the case of Grand Illusion, Jean Renoir's 1938 classic, the brilliant DVD transfer was the result of a lucky break, the recent discovery of a complete print captured and protected, first by the Nazis and then by the Russians after the war.
There's a part of it that is about detective work, and there's a great kind of satisfaction in that eureka moment when you find the things that you never knew existed.
Criterion's edition of Grand Illusion includes Renoir's own introduction to the film, recorded in 1958.
And I had a very good friend, a wonderful man, a great fighter. His name was Captain Passer. Captain Passer was shot down 7 times by the Germans. He was taken to a prison camp 7 times, and he escaped 7 times. The story of Grand Illusion is based on the evasions of Captain Passer.
Collecting all of the things that might be lost, but that are somehow related to the identity of a film, related to the mood in which it was made, that can be very much part of it.
One of Criterion's most ambitious productions is its 3-disc rendering of Terry Gilliam's 1985 film Brazil, which includes the 94-minute studio release, the 142-minute director's cut, and a great deal more, including an hour-long documentary of Gilliam's famous fight with Hollywood.
I would get calls from the editor occasionally wanting my input. What do you mean you want my input? Yeah, but we're saving your film. No, you're killing my film. You're destroying it. You've taken the child, and you're asking which limb do you want chopped off?
For some filmmakers, the DVD version is the one for posterity, the final statement, the place for stray snatches of inspiration, selected sweepings from the cutting room floor. Richard LeGravenaise wrote The Fisher King and The Bridges of Madison County and wrote and directed 1998's Living Out Loud.
You can always tell yourself, well, at least I'll put it on the DVD and someone will get to see it. Whereas in the old days, it was just lost forever. Exactly. It lessens the pain of losing one of your little darlings, which is what William Goldman, a great screenwriter, refers to as those pieces that are just so perfect, or perhaps a scene that was the whole reason you did the film. And then by the end of it, you realize it's the one thing that has to be sacrificed, like Isaac and Abraham.
DVDs have immense storage capacity, so much so that the DVD of Terminator 2 is able to include three complete versions of the film, plus an audio commentary with 26 members of the cast and crew, not to mention additional interviews, storyboards, featurettes, and trailers. Fantasia 2000 has an additional 11 hours of programming. And how about the interminable commentary for Battlefield Earth?
Huge kind of machinery. You're not quite sure what it does, but you know that...
It's smoky, stinky, and everything, but something comes out of there that's beyond our explanation.
It's kind of steampunky.
Is there such a thing as too much information? Some directors, Steven Spielberg and Peter Weir, for example, won't do commentary tracks. And Criterion's Peter Becker said that Rob Reiner, as he sat down to talk through his film Spinal Tap, was frankly wary.
The very first thing that he said was, I can tell you a lot that will increase your understanding of how this movie was made, but it will very likely decrease your enjoyment. And he encouraged viewers to listen at their own risk.
But the inescapable fact that DVDs are flying off the shelves suggests that knowing the tricks of the trade, continuity and steadicams, pyrotechnics and animatronics, does not diminish the magic of the movies. It just brings you a little closer to the magician.
You talking to me?
You're doing something in a mirror.
You talking to me?
That idea fit the whole thing of somebody by themselves, talking themselves, acting that way. Huh?
Well, who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Listening to all those commentaries has made us wish we had behind-the-scenes insights on big media events. Of course, there's always a big delay before the DVD comes out, but On the Media has finally obtained the director's commentary on President Bush's first address to Congress last February.
I know Congress had to formally invite me, and it could have been a close vote. So, Mr. Vice President, I appreciate you being here to break the tie.
We had so many more laugh lines at the top.
Right. What was it? He thanked the Supreme Court?
Right. The line was, and if the other side wins, we'll take it to the Supreme Court. And he thanks Bill Clinton for keeping the heat off of him.
And the Surgeon General or something?
No, no. It was a Surgeon General, because I'm going to be doing so much butt kissing to get this thing passed. I'm going to need a lip transplant.
Funny stuff. But there's nowhere to go from there.
No, the Cheney line was the best.
Education is not my top priority. Education is my top priority and by supporting this
budget. Ah, yes, the famous flub. Do you want to tell this one?
Sure. Nobody believes me, but it was in the script.
I know people will stop me on the street to this day to ask about that line, but that's exactly what we were after.
It was meant to give the viewer a sense of unease. Wait, what's he saying? Education is not my top priority? And then he comes right back.
Yeah, he comes back with education is my top priority. And it's like, I thought it was.
Exactly. If he just says the line as a line, no big deal. But if he prefaces it with that little flub, everyone talks about it.
Bush equals education because of the flub.
It's a little trick.
For an actor, I think it's the toughest line in the script.
Exactly.
With us tonight is the mayor of Philadelphia.
Of course, the mayor of Philadelphia was too expensive, so we had to get the mayor of Vancouver.
Can't tell the difference.
No, same thing.
I like teachers so much, I married one.
Now, that didn't test well.
No, you're right. When we screened it in Culver City, some of the cards that came back were from teachers themselves.
Right. A couple teachers who saw it at screenings were scared he'd be coming right after them next.
I never even thought of that when I wrote it.
No, but I thought it was a good line, so I fought for it. One of the few fights I won.
That's real money. With us tonight, representing many American families, are Stephen and Josefina Ramos.
Stephen and Josefina. Where did you come up with those names?
Those are the names of my grandmother's cats.
I never knew that.
Our parks are places of great natural beauty and history.
At this point, almost exactly halfway through the speech, we cut away to a montage sequence of Bush at play in the parks with walking on sunshine underneath him.
Katrina and the waves.
Exactly. George frolicking at Old Faithful, George teasing a family of bears, George twirling on a mountaintop. Mm. And we pull back, way back. It's an homage to the opening shot of Sound of Music.
Sublime. It's in the added features at the end of the disc.
That's it for this week's show. That's it for this year's shows. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keith, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis, Michael Cavanaugh, and Allison Lichter. Our web mistress is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme, not to be confused with this. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And when you do, please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Happy holidays.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.